Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On March 26th, North Korea apparently torpedoed and sank a South Korean Navy vessel, killing 46 sailors. As blunt a casus belli as any of North Korea's sometimes oddball provocations in years, would South Korea strike back militarily? Not so easy. And not just because even a short war would likely be catastrophically destructive, but also because the Korean Peninsula sits in the middle of the conversation between big power China and the USA. This hour on Point, the Korea standoff, its stakes, and everybody trying to figure out what comes next. You can join the conversation. What would you do if your loud, belligerent, and nuclear-armed neighbor sank one of your ships and killed your sailors? What if it was this neighbor, North Korea? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear from Korea today and around the region. Joining me right now from Beijing to bring us up to date on the story is John Pomfret, diplomatic and Asian affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. People have paid a lot of attention to exactly how China responded to the sinking of the Cheonan Korean warship on March 26th. Remind us just how long it took China to respond to South Korea, John.
Well, first, it took China almost a month to express its condolences to South Korea for the death of the sailors, which was really extraordinary. I mean, basically, when there's, for example, a tornado in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. China will always express its condolences almost immediately to the United States. So this is really an extraordinarily long time for China to move diplomatically on this front.
And then just as it was coming into focus that it was going to look like a North Korean torpedo here, China invited the leader of North Korea to Beijing.
Right. And also after the South Koreans issued the results of their investigation last week, China has yet to accept those results, even though they were basically an international investigation involving American, British, Australian, Sweden, and other governments in assisting the South Koreans with the investigation. So it's very interesting. China's response has been has really angered, actually, the South Koreans.
We don't know what's going to happen on the ground here, but there's a big push for a diplomatic response at the UN Security Council. Hillary Clinton was in Beijing with a huge 200-person American entourage this week asking and talking about lots of things, this among them. Did she come away with an agreement by China not to veto a Security Council measure reprimand or something on North Korea?
No, I don't think they really got any clear indication from China about what it's going to do on this issue. And I think this is something that's worried her. I think it worried the Americans. Because China obviously can veto that if it's a strong resolution on this issue, and so I think that's a big concern on the part of the Americans.
John, you've been writing that China's attitude toward this attack is underscoring how differently Beijing and Washington view the Korean Peninsula. For that matter, how differently Beijing may see it from Seoul or Tokyo.
Yeah, I mean, for years we've let these extremely important disagreements basically be put under the rug as the United States and South Korea and Japan and Russia have worked to try to push North Korea to get rid of its nuclear weapons. But the problem is that there's a fundamental disagreement between the United States, Korea, and Japan on one side and the Chinese on the other about sort of the future of the Korean Peninsula. The Chinese really do not want to see the Korean Peninsula united.
Why?
Whereas, well, a united Korean Peninsula could potentially do two things. It would first involve, obviously, the collapse of North Korea, mm-hmm. which would mean immediately China would probably get around 300,000 refugees running into its territory. So in terms of just basic instability, China doesn't want that. But secondly, China likes the fact that it has a big authoritarian government on its border, sort of as a buffer state from the capitalist South Korea. And a united Korean Peninsula would obviously be under South Korean control, and that would be something that the Chinese would look to as a threat.
So does China just turn a blind eye to this? It's the closest government on earth to Pyongyang. Does it just do nothing?
Well, that's a great question, Tom, and I think the Chinese are befuddled. I mean, they really are in a very difficult position. If you talk to Chinese scholars, they basically say, you know, we just really don't know what to do. And so the Chinese have been basically asking everyone to be calm. And it's sort of there's a joke in the Western intelligence community, you know, China's symbols, the PRC, the People's Republic of China, but actually it also just means please remain calm. And that's what the Chinese have been asking everyone to do. And the South Koreans' response is, hey, we just had 46 sailors murdered. How can you expect us to be calm? But the Chinese are saying we need to stay cool on this because China really is worried about the collapse of North Korea more than anything, and actually in some ways more than ever before.
You're writing that after a period in which China's influence in the region seemed sharply ascendant, that this, among other perhaps missteps recently, has turned people back toward the United States.
Yeah, that's a really interesting shift you're seeing now. For years, in the early years of the 21st century, people were writing, China's soft power is going to dominate the region. Everyone's shifting towards China. From Thailand to Malaysia, Indonesia, all the way up to Japan, you see sort of pro-China elements taking over. But now there's a real shift away from China, because as China rises, it's starting to get very big and very bad. It's sort of, and its attitude is almost similar to sort of late 19th century America than, you know, a developing country with a per capita GDP of about 6,000 a head. It really is feeling its oats, and that's concerning a lot of people in the region. And this type of incident, in addition to things like recently it's pushed the PLA Navy through Japanese territorial waters.
That's the People's Liberation Army and the Blue Water Chinese Navy, therefore.
Exactly. It buzzed some Japanese warships with its helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
That's really concerning Japan as well. So it's not just South Korea.
How do you think this gets resolved, John? You're the Asian affairs correspondent there. I mean, what does happen between the South and the North after 46 sailors dead and a warship down?
Well, right now there's an escalation. But at the same time, I think you're seeing both the Americans trying to work very closely with the South Koreans to ensure that they don't sort of go off the deep end. And I think more and more you're going to see the Chinese working on the North Koreans to make sure that they don't go off the deep end. The problem is, you know, these two countries, South Korea and North Korea, have, you know, fought an incredibly bloody war in the 50s and really have yet up to have no real serious peace deal. And so there's a lot of concern that this thing could fly off the handle. I think the Chinese are really concerned about that, as are the Americans.
John Pomfret is diplomatic and Asian affairs correspondent for The Washington Post, author of Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates, and the Story of the New China. He joined us from Beijing. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's go to Seoul, South Korea, right in the thick of things. We're joined there by Ambassador Chung Min Lee. He's Ambassador for International Security Affairs and Global Issues for the Government of South Korea. He's also Dean of the Graduate School of International Studies at Yonsei University. Ambassador Chung, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's a real pleasure to be back on air with NPR, and I'd like to say good morning or good evening, depending on what time it is over in your neck of the woods, to all your listeners in the States.
And I apologize if I've got your surname wrong there. Perhaps it's Ambassador Lee. Forgive me.
That's right. That's okay.
First of all, let's look back to this apparent torpedoing. Number one, do you agree with the international assessment that this was, it seems, a North Korean torpedo? And number two, why would North Korea have done this in the first place in March?
Well, on your first question, there was a 74-member investigation team that was that included not only South Korean military and civilian officials, but also experts from the U.S., Australia, Sweden, and Great Britain. And all of the team members agreed unanimously when they signed off on the report, which came out on May 20th, that this, excuse me, was done by a North Korean torpedo. The smoking gun, so to speak, was a propeller shaft we retrieved from under the sea where the boat was sunk on March 26th. And there were other chemical residues. There was forensic evidence. And every single point of factual evidence basically concluded beyond a shadow of the doubt that this was a North Korean torpedo. Now, why did they do this at this particular time? There are a number of conjectures. I'd like to give you three.
Okay.
The first is North Korea announced a major currency devaluation in December last year, which was disastrous. So the economy, which was already tanking, basically went down south even further. And the person who allegedly basically did this policy deal was Kim Jong-il's third son and the anointed heir, Kim Jong-un, who's only 27 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so they needed a scapegoat as the North Korean economy was faltering. The second issue is the Lee Myung-bok government, which came into office 2 years ago.
The South Korean president, yes.
Mm-hmm. North Korea. That's right. Mm-hmm. And so the South Korean policy shifted from, you know, unilateral engagement to a much more balanced policy towards Pyongyang. And Kim Jong-il might have been extremely upset that all of his antics were not working, i.e., all of the cash shipments to North Korea, which have been handled by the previous two governments in South Korea. And the third possible motivation is that the army in North Korea, which is very, very strong, basically has the upper hand, and that Kim Jong-il is no longer calling the shots, but it's the Korean People's Army that really has the upper hand in the workings of the North Korean regime today.
We're going to look at all these scenarios and the bigger factors that play around this. At the heart of it, you've been watching for a long time. Do you think there's a chance of war here, or is that off the table, given the stakes?
Now, let me reassure all your listeners in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world, the chance of war happening on the Korean Peninsula today and in the near future is basically zero. And the reason is very simple. It's because of Mr. Obama's, President Obama's, very direct support for the South Korean government. Hillary Clinton, your Secretary of State, was in town today for a few hours, mm-hmm. met with our president, the foreign minister. And there is no shade of gray or daylight between Seoul and Washington. So the deterrence that is in place in Korea and elsewhere basically is very, very strong.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Korean standoff, North and South Korea, the U.S. and China, Japan, all trying to figure out what comes next here. Ambassador Chungmin Lee joins us from Seoul, South Korea, Ambassador, South Korea's ambassador for international security affairs and global issues there. On Monday, after South Korea's official inquiry said it found proof that a North Korean torpedo sank its ship, this international inquiry, South Korean President Lee Myung-bak said things are different now and his government would, one way or another, retaliate.
We have always tolerated North Korea's brutality, time and again. We did so because we have always had a genuine longing for peace on the Korean Peninsula. But now things are different. North Korea will pay a price that corresponds to its provocative acts. I will continue to take stern measures to hold the North accountable.
North Korea will pay a price. There, the South Korean president yesterday, the day after that announcement, the South Korea saying it would retaliate economically for the torpedo attack, North Korea's government television newscast responded with its own version of events and some saber rattling.
Should the South's intrusion into the territorial waters of our side continue, the DPRK will put into force practical military measures to defend its waters, as it already clarified, and the South will be held fully accountable for all the ensuing consequences.
The DPRK, North Korea. Ambassador Lee, what do you make of that back and forth? We've heard saber rattling for decades from North Korea. Is there something different this time?
I think Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang really miscalculated the outcome of this particular incident. It's a tragic incident. Over the last four decades, the North Koreans have sent in commandos. They've sank our airplanes. They've bombed airplanes, excuse me. They have tried to, they killed 17 members of our cabinet in visiting Burma in 1983. So
right.
This is a long history of a very long terrorist war. And this saber rattling is continuing because North Korea is boxed into a corner. They basically sank our corvette, killed 46 sailors, and are denying basically that they had nothing to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just give you one example. The Chinese government have been very, very silent. They've been very neutral in many respects, and they've got some criticism for this particular, I guess, silence.
Mm-hmm.
But today, just a few hours ago, one of the offshoots of the People's Daily, called the Global Times, came out with an editorial. And let me just read you one sentence.
It says,
quote, "This is a cold reality confronting Pyongyang. Now is that South Korea has presented evidence so overwhelming that it has gained full support from the U.S. and Japan and dominated worldwide public opinion on this issue. In contrast, North Korea is merely thrown in strong verbiage, along with the threat of an all-out war. Its reaction will by no means help Pyongyang get out of the current predicament. Instead, it can only come at the heady price of further isolation from the rest of the world. And this is coming from a semi-official newspaper from the People's Republic of China. So even our Chinese friends, as cautious as they are coming to realize that you cannot refute facts.
We'll talk about what role China might play in reining things in here. But if we can just go back to the incident for a second, Ambassador Lee. This sinking was off of Benyang Island, something about 100 miles west of, I don't know, Seoul or the South Korean shore, fairly near North Korea, where it juts out there. What was going on? Was this corvette, this Navy warship, in a standard patrol there? Was it a provocative patrol? And what would it have taken for North Korea to do this? Would it have taken an order from the very top of the North Korean government?
Well, first of all, that Pyongyang Island, we have three or four islands on the western side, western coast of the Yellow Sea. And as you said, it is very close to the North Korean border, and that's called the Northern Limitation Line. And that NLL is a maritime boundary between South and North Korea that was agreed upon after the end of the Korean War in 1953.
Right.
The Chunan, which was our corvette, a 1,300-ton ship, was on a routine mission. And the reason is for the last several years, North Korean warships have come across the NLL, and we've had skirmishes dating back to 1999, 2004, and more recently at the end of last year, 2009. And so our patrols are there to make sure that, number one, North Korean vessels, including their naval vessels, do not come into our own territorial waters, and number two, that if they do, we will repel them. And so when the North Koreans basically lost out last time, we are basically assessing the fact that there were two mini North Korean submarines that basically went into our waters and then basically waited until the Chunan was inside, launched the torpedo, and then went back into their naval base in North Korea.
Describe for us, you're there in Seoul. What has the, I mean, the official government reaction from South Korea has been very sober, very steady, no rush to any to action here. What's the emotional reaction among Koreans been? I mean, this is a pretty in-your-face provocation. And quite deadly.
You know, we have 49, 50 million people living in South Korea. We are a trillion-dollar economy, the world's ninth largest trading power. And we're about to host a G20 summit in November this year. This is a globalized, democratized, very modernized metropolitan city as well as a country. All South Koreans are shocked. Now, of course, depending on your political view, you could have different views. But for the last 10 years, under successive governments who basically practiced engagement policy called the Sunshine Policy, we expected that North Korea's behavior would change. And I think Koreans were shell-shocked because over the last 10 years, we've poured in millions of dollars, we've given them lots of aid, tons of food and everything else, and still they really haven't changed. And that fact, more than anything else, really has jolted the South Korean people. And so we realize that despite all of our goodwill, the North Koreans have fired nuclear, tested nuclear weapons. They've lobbed off long-range missiles, and now they have killed 46 of our sailors. And yet, despite all of this, we have to remain calm and steady and resolute because nobody in South Korea wants another war.
Would you just remind us of why? I mean, it's always unpalatable, but of why it is so particularly unimaginable in the Korean Peninsula's case to think of armed conflict again.
You know, in 1950, 10 years before I was born, the North Koreans launched an all-out war. Millions of Koreans died on both sides. And we were saved only because of the resolve of our own people, but also, critically, because American forces came in and defended us with 16 other nations under the UN umbrella. Now, you have now the world's 14th largest economy, that's South Korea. We're the fourth largest economy in Asia. We trade with every country in the entire planet. We receive 99% of our oil from the Middle East and elsewhere. We are basically, tied to the world and vice versa. And so if anything really bad happens politically or militarily in particular, there will not only be huge casualties in terms of numbers of human casualties, the economy of the Republic of Korea will basically go down south. And you simply cannot afford that. And none of the great powers, China, Russia, Japan, and the U.S., want to be involved in another protracted bloody war on the Korean Peninsula. On that point, there is no disagreement between Beijing, Moscow, Tokyo, and Washington.
So how to handle this? We're going to hear in just a moment from our friend David Kong at the University of Southern California. Let me take a call or two, if I may. Nick in Shenandoah Valley, Virginia. Nick, you're on the air with Ambassador Chungmin Lee.
Yeah, hello. I've worked at DoD intelligence for years, and we did North Korean issues, and I was always amazed at how North Korea is able to hold the world hostage. It's basically a petulant child of China. If China didn't support North Korea, it would have probably collapsed, you know, several years ago. And the only way to solve the issue is to have, you know, China solve it, basically. I've always thought, too, South Korea really doesn't have an interest in solving this issue right now themselves, because they would, like, not unlike when the Berlin Wall collapsed, you know, West Germany had to absorb East Germany, and the economic ramifications were that were very dramatic. And I think in the case of South Korea, they would also have to absorb this really backwards, economically depressed country, and their economy would suffer greatly, I think, if they had to absorb North Korea.
And Nick, war, when you're at the DoD, did you consider it a real possibility or just off the table?
Off the table in many respects, because basically everyone knows you really can't push North Korea too far, because right now there are at least 1 million artillery rounds able to reach the capital within, you know, hours. So basically Seoul would be obliterated. It'd be like Washington, D.C. being obliterated by, you know, artillery rounds, you know, north of the city. So the only way militarily that the South could ever force the issue with North Korea would be to evacuate Seoul and basically pull, you know, most of the population south, and then be able to mount some kind of offensive military, you know, strike into North Korea. But, you know that in itself would be a major provocative act of war to all of a sudden evacuate your entire capital. I think the North would figure that out.
We're talking nightmare scenario in a hurry there. Nick, thanks for your call. I want to invite David Kong into our conversation. He's director of the Korean Studies Institute and professor of international relations and business at the University of Southern California, author of China Rising and co-author of Nuclear North Korea. David Kong, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi there.
You heard our caller say only China can solve this, and I'm not sure what that means when it comes to North Korea. I mean, some people have said, could China, with all of its influence, actually install a different government in North Korea by one way or another? Is that a possibility? Is that even on the table?
Well, I think China... I think in some ways we overestimate how much influence China has on North Korea. China has clearly more influence over North Korea than any other country, but it has less, I think, than we tend to think that it has. And the problem for China is that, yeah, they could make the regime collapse, but that's an incredibly blunt type of action. And the consequences, as John Pomfret was talking about, could be even worse. And so the Chinese government has a really difficult situation here. The status quo tends to work basically for everybody because we don't know how much worse it could be if you upset things. The thing that China's been doing over the last 5 or 10 years has been very clearly trying to push North Korea to follow economic reforms along the lines that China did. And the North Koreans are clearly resisting that, as Chungmin Lee pointed out.
Ambassador Lee, if arms are off the table, and we hope they stay there, what are the options for South Korea, for the world, to have North Korea pay some price for sinking a South Korean Navy ship, killing 46 sailors?
Well, before I answer that question, let me just say it's a great pleasure to be talking together with David Kong, a dear friend of mine, and one of the top American scholars who follow North Korean and Northeast Asian affairs. On that question, how do you hurt or make North Koreans pay? Well, the most important point is to cut off their cash pipeline. Over the last 10 years, the South Korean government has given through trade and incentives and aid billions of dollars. And last year, inter-Korean trade, although it has dropped somewhat, was about $1.7 billion U.S. Altogether, including our aid, it comes out to about $3 billion in hard currency that North Korea gains from us every single year. And from this year onwards, that aid is going to dry up. So how does North Korea make up the deficit? Well, they've sold narcotics, they sell missiles to the Middle East, they're into counterfeiting and so forth. And the international community understands, including the U.S. and our EU partners, that if you cut off North Korea's cash line, that's really going to hurt Kim Jong-il.
Are you saying that South Korea is going to cut off that $3 billion cash flow in retaliation for the sinking of the warship?
But in fact, we've already decided to do so. The president announced a couple of days ago a number of measures, including diplomatic, et cetera. And the first words he said were, look, we need a sincere apology from the North Koreans, but if that is not forthcoming, and they do not basically step up to the plate and admit that they did this heinous act, we will basically cut off all trade and economic relations with North Korea, period, except for minimum humanitarian assistance to the younger children and so forth, including baby food and so forth. So basically, the Korean government's position on this is very, very clear. We're going to cut off money to North Korea because this is one of the ways to pay back what they did. Now, you must realize that inter-Korean trade only amounts to 0.87% of South Korea's overall trade volume. So even if the North Koreans, as they've said yesterday, would cut off all economic ties with South Korea, it basically does nothing in terms of denting our economic, I guess, profile.
What are the ramifications for North Korea of losing that $3 billion in hard currency a year? What does it mean for the regime there?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. China provides about 70 to 80% of North Korea's oil, fuel, and food supplies. Basically, it's a barter trade, and in return, North Koreans have given the Chinese long-term leases on minerals and other resources and mines and so forth. They simply don't have the cash. Now, Kim Jong-il, we believe, has a personal asset between $2 and $3 billion stashed away in secret accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere, and Macau, et cetera. Mm. And so here you have a regime that cannot feed its own people, and yet its leadership, Kim Jong-il and his family, have billions of dollars in stashed away cash. Why does he need the money? He needs cold cash to pay off the key people in the army, the intelligence agencies, and the government and the party. And when that fund dries up, the loyalty that they've shown towards Kim Jong-il and his family will also winnow and weaken over time.
David Kang, do you think cutting off the cash, the step that South Korea is now taking, could destabilize North Korea, bring down the Kim regime?
I think if there's a very strong economic sanctions, then particularly financial sanctions, you could destabilize and possibly topple the regime. The problem, as Ambassador Lee pointed out, is that China has shown a lack of willingness to really go along with this. So even though China signed on to the most recent UN sanctions, 17-18, which were put in place a couple of years ago, they are a signatory to the sanctions, and yet Chinese trade with North Korea continues to increase. So without China actually deciding that they're going to be a part of the sanctions regime, I think it'll be difficult to really squeeze them to the point that they are actually hurting.
Why do you think North Korea did this in the first place, David Kang?
The Chunan incident?
Yes, the torpedo. Why?
I think Ambassador Lee has, none of us really know, right? My own speculation, based on no internal conversations in North Korea, is that it's probably more domestic focused. I tend to lean towards the side that Kim Jong-un, the son of the current leader, he's too young. He has no military credentials. He has no nationalist credentials. And this is possibly a way of either giving him legitimacy among the generals or letting him show that he can be some kind of a leader. So my sense is that it's more internally focused because of palace politics than external.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Korean standoff, North and South Korea, the U.S. and China, Japan, all trying to figure out what comes next. Ambassador Chung Min Lee of South Korea is with us from Seoul, the capital of South Korea, ambassador there for international security affairs and global issues. He's dean of the Graduate School of International Studies at Yonsei University. David Kang is with us from Los Angeles. He's director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California, author of China Rising and Nuclear North Korea. Let's get to some of our callers. Nicholas in Rochester, Massachusetts. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. My question goes right to reunification. We demonize North Korea, but I heard what Ambassador Lee said about China may not want a capitalist country on its border. Why can't the international community put pressure on China and reunify North and South Korea, so families can be together again.
Nicholas, thank you for your call. Ambassador Lee, you hear the question. Of course, many Koreans have asked it over the years. How does reunification sit in relation to this whole controversy and the interests of the parties here?
I see. Okay. Well, first of all, Nicholas, thank you for your question from Rochester, Minnesota. I basically did not say that the Chinese do not want to say unified Korean Peninsula. And I think that's what my colleague David Kong said, vis-a-vis, for example, China's longer-term strategic interests as North Korea as a buffer state. But I think all Koreans want to see a unified, democratic, market economy, internationally tied Korean Peninsula. You're absolutely right, Nicholas. There are many millions of Koreans who have separated families in the North, including my father, for example, who's 82 years old. And so we want to see a unified Korea before my father passes away. Now, that's going to take many years, perhaps. We will work this through, but the ultimate goal is to have a unified peninsula. The Korean Peninsula was divided because of great power politics. This had nothing to do with the desire of the Korean people, both living in the South and the North. And I think all the great powers have a vested interest and a stake in ensuring that at some point in time in history, this becomes a reality.
Why do you say that? I mean, China might look at it, or the United States for that matter, and say, well, if Korea reunifies and becomes one country, that would be a big, difficult, long-term problem. Let's say it happened. Well, then is it going to be tilting toward China or tilting toward the United States? And could either superpower accept a tilt in the other direction, Ambassador Lee?
Well, I think so, because look at this. You know, I lived in Germany as a young boy. Germany was unified 20 years ago when the Berlin Wall collapsed, and then they were reunified in October 1990. Germany today is a solid, democratic, economic powerhouse of the European Union. And the Russians and the British and the French and the Americans have all accepted Germany as a unified state. Now, the situation, of course, here is clearly different. But I believe that at some point in time, you simply cannot stop the aspirations of 70 million Koreans, both living in the North and in the South. Now, there are some people who might argue, well, unified Korea might be more pro-China, could have nuclear weapons, etc. The conditions are pretty clear in my mind. A unified Korea should never have nuclear weapons, should never have offensive weapons that threatens directly the Chinese or the PRs or the Russians or even the Japanese. And so you must have a unified Korea that is strongly tied to the global community. And if we see that happen, and basically the writing's on the wall, which is you have a 50 million strong South Korean government and a nation that is modern and that is tied to the world. And a unified Korea will be an extension of that. And we have to basically make sure that we level up the living standards of our North Korean brothers.
David Kong, how do you see it? I mean, unification seems a long way off right now with what's right in front of us here. But is that, let's say Korea said, all right, we'll be unified, we'll be non-nuclear, we'll be a kind of Switzerland in Northeast Asia. Could everybody live with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with the more extreme, particularly sort of South Korean conspiracy theories that nobody wants unification. I think all the governments, China, Japan, the United States, realize that the North Korean problem is an extraordinary waste of time, energy, and money, and that if you can get to the point past the transition stage, a unified Korea, a democratic, capitalist, rich, vibrant Korean peninsula is good for everybody in the region. The problem is, how do you get there? And so the concerns are much more about the costs that it would be to rebuild North Korea, et cetera. But I don't see in the long term this being against anyone's national interest.
Well, I wonder if Beijing sees it that way, though. I mean, if you look at long history, China was the hegemon forever and ever, and there was a unified Korea almost all the time on its flank. And that clearly was a situation China could live with. But that was before we're getting way back. That was before the New World. That was before the United States of America and the superpower across the Pacific.
Well, in a way, I'd say that's one of the reasons that I think that there's room for optimism, right? I mean, the Korean Peninsula has been unified since the 7th century.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been unified political control of the Korean Peninsula up to the Yalu for about 1,300 years. And big China has always been bigger than the Korean Peninsula. So those two countries know how to live with each other. The problem for Korea in the modern world, as you pointed out, is that no longer is China the only country, and the U.S. is there particularly. So as people like to talk about, Korea can be the dagger pointed at the heart of this country or that country. Mm. Long-term, Korea's fundamental strategic problem will be to have good relations with both China and the United States. And the thing I'd point out is that the worst option or the worst decision for Korea, a unified Korea or even a South Korea, is to be forced to choose if either the U.S. or China tries to force the Koreans to choose one side or another. And as long as they can avoid that, I think the options are good. But it is a strategic dilemma for Korea.
If we're talking centuries, then in the nearer term than that, I think you've said there may be attraction on all sides to a kind of new Cold War standoff over Korea. The unsolved situation may have certain attraction.
Well, that's what I was alluding to before, is not in the sense of a conspiracy to keep the peninsula divided, but given that the costs of actually unifying and the uncertainty about what the North Korean military would do, whether you'd have 300,000 refugees or 3 million refugees, means that the status quo, in a lot of senses, works for everybody in the short term. And the really sad part is the status quo is in everybody's interest in the short term because we don't have to deal with the consequences. But the long term, of course, this problem just doesn't go away.
Let's go to Nathan in Bessemer City, North Carolina. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I spent a year in South Korea in Tongjeong. I guess it's near the border.
Were you in the U.S. military, Nathan?
I was in the U.S. Army.
Yes, sir.
And I saw a lot in the younger generation, a lot of resistance through direct resistance and through protests outside the base of the presence in the United States. Now, in the older generation, or in the generation that was directly affected by the Korean War, there was a lot of respect for the U.S. presence in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is with this new attack and the new worry of war with North Korea, is there going to be a newfound appreciation for the presence of the United States in South Korea? Because I recognize that we've been at least a negative effect in the social status in South Korea, because we caused a lot of problems. It's a lot of young soldiers.
It's a big footprint.
We have a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And they want us out. So the question is are they going to want us to stay now?
It's a good question, Nathan. Ambassador Lee, how do you see it? You talk about Joe Kimchi, sort of Joe Sixpack with your red-hot Korean cabbage there. What about the ordinary Korean young, old, and attitudes on this side of this attack?
Well, Nathan, first of all, thank you so much on behalf of the Korean government for serving in my country, even for two or three years. First of all, in a democratic society like South Korea, you'll have different opinions about the U.S. forces. And Nathan is absolutely right. There are younger people who really want to see a more independent South Korea. There's an older generation who feel very attached to the U.S. for a number of reasons. Let me just give you one indication of a recent poll. Now, younger Koreans, those in their 30s and 20s and even their early 40s age group, basically said that 60% wanted the South Koreans to be independent at some point in time. 90% said, however, that in the case of an emergency or a crisis, they really will depend on the U.S. to come and help us. So there's a bifurcated view on the role of the U.S. Now, the U.S. forces have a large main base here in Seoul, not too far from where I live in Itaewon. They will be moved south over the next 4 or 5 years, so there will be base relocation. There are 26,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, and today the overwhelming majority of Koreans basically support a robust U.S.-ROK alliance, and I think that basic friendship and positive attitude has been strengthened on account of this tragedy over the Cheonan incident when 46 sailors were killed. So I think most Koreans realize there are issues. We will never agree on all of them, but there's a very strong consensus that we need and we want the U.S. to be here as long as both of us feel the need for them to be here.
So where does this go, David Kung? It's headed for the U.N. Security Council. There are already steps that, as Ambassador Lee says, South Korea is taking to, cut off that hard currency. What else can the global community do or the U.N. do that might bring some pressure to bear on North Korea? And if there are internal stakes as high as the ascendancy, as high as succession here to power in North Korea, is there anything the rest of the world can do that will really change North Korea's behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit pessimistic on that note, because I think the status quo and a sort of new Cold War actually is good for the leadership in North Korea as well. I mean, I think they welcome this in their own sort of twisted worldview as justifying everything that they've done. And that the more pressure that comes on them, the more they're like, we were right, we should continue. So in many ways, I think it's a way of their own convincing themselves that this hard line and no reforms is good for North Korea. So I think the short term is that, you know, everybody's based, I don't want to say happy with this, but the kind of pressure that we could bring is fairly limited. Because the other thing that we often tend to forget about this is that the range of options is very wafer thin. As Ambassador Lee pointed, John, everybody knows Pomfret, actual military, you know, a full-scale mobilization is unthinkable. So that if that, because of the costs, is off the table, you're left with economic sanctions, diplomatic pressure, and various types of indirect ways of trying to get North Korea to change.
Well, what about China? Don't they have more options? I mean, they must be very deeply embedded in North Korea at this point. Couldn't China, coup is an ugly word, but couldn't China bring some new strain of leadership to power? Or is that just not anywhere in there?
Well, I think as if we just sort of look around at the times that for example, the U.S. has installed, quote, puppet governments in, say, South Vietnam, right. Other places, it's not actually easy to control these people. And so I don't think necessarily that even if China pulled a coup or got one of their own guys in, that they'd be able to actually pull the strings as well as we think. And the example that I often use is, it's very clear the Chinese have been trying to get the North Koreans to follow their economic reforms, and the North Koreans have resisted. So, yeah, China could pull the plug. I mean, if they decided to, you know, make the regime collapse, they could. But as I said, that's a very blunt instrument, and people are very wary about doing that.
Here's the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. This is in Seoul today, talking about the crisis with officials there and here talking with reporters at a press briefing.
The U.S. and South Korean militaries have announced plans for joint exercises, and we will explore further enhancements to our posture on the peninsula to ensure readiness and to deter future attacks. The United States is also reviewing additional options and authorities to hold North Korea and its leaders accountable.
Options and authorities. And right at the top of that, Ambassador Lee, military exercises is, and I understand what was planned, maybe still is anti-submarine exercises right back in the spot where the Chonan, the warship, was sunk. Is that going forward? Is that a provocation? Or are we going to see more? Everybody says no war, no fighting, but if it's right back in the same zone, could we?
Well, first of all, let me reassure you that all of the military exercises that we conduct with the U.S. forces are defensive in nature. And we tell the Chinese, the Russians, and even the North Koreans well in advance that we are going to conduct these exercises. What Secretary Clinton alluded to was very crucial because a North Korean mini-sub torpedoed our warship. And so therefore, we want to enhance early warning capabilities, enhance our anti-submarine warfare capabilities. These exercises will be held within South Korean waters, and they will not intrude in North Korean territory or sovereignty. That's number one. And number two, the South Korean military, for its part, we are changing the rules of engagement so that we can respond much more effectively if the North Koreans do another provocative military action. We will also participate much more forcefully in the so-called Proliferation Security Initiative, and the South Korean military has also restarted a military broadcast towards the North Korean forces. So these are all comprehensive measures, but they are short of a unilateral military attack on North Korea. That, as David Kong said, is basically not being tabled or considered by anyone in Washington or Seoul at this particular time, nor in the future.
So, Ambassador, when the shouting dies down, when the dust settles here, what's happened? What's changed? Anything? Is it just status quo ante, as if the sinking of a South Korean warship never happened? Or do you think something significant has changed?
I think there are very, very important benchmarks we're going to see in the next 3, 4, 6 months. The most important is this. The entire global community, including our friends in Beijing, now must realize that what North Korea did contravenes not only the South-North Armistice Agreement, the 1991 Basic Agreement, the UN Charter, you name it. They have basically violated every piece of paper they ever put their signature on. And so this will convince the international community that doing business with the North Koreans, as usual, simply cannot continue. So whether it's at the UN, whether it's international financial sanctions, there will be pressure on North Korea. They are the, perhaps outside of Myanmar or the late Burma, the most isolated regime in the entire planet. And their isolation is going to get even worse because the Chinese will now realize, I believe, that North Korea is no longer an asset, but a huge liability for them, strategically, militarily, and diplomatically.
David Kang, does that, bottom line, just 20 seconds here, but does that mean a change? Or are we back to where we were, a super isolated North Korea?
Well, I think the big change is that the U.S. and South Korea are cooperating very, very closely. And so on that, I think that there's been genuine movement forwards.
And interestingly, in that way, maybe out of all this, a resurgence of American influence in the region. What a fascinating issue, dangerous, but deeply interesting on the strategic front. David Kang at the University of Southern California, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Ambassador Chungmin Lee in Seoul, South Korea, thank you for joining us, sir.
Well, thank you. Can I just have one 5 seconds?
I'm afraid we're out of time. This is On Point.